Music journalist and author Tony Fletcher has spent decades chronicling rock and roll and the culture surrounding it. His new book, Pow, When UK Went Pop, 1980 to 1984, turns the lens on his own youth, a coming-of-age story set against a wildly creative moment in British music. Fletcher recalls life as a teenage journalist and aspiring musician, navigating the record business, love, sex, and the hard lessons of growing up while trying to land his own band a record deal. This Sunday at 2 p.m., Fletcher brings Powell to the Orpheum Theater in Saugerties, New York, for a reading, conversation, and videos from the era. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tony Fletcher to the roundtable this morning. Tony, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be here, Joe.
I love talking to you. Of course, you have written about Keith Moon, you've written about REM, you've written about the Smiths. This is a memoir. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what brought you to this point of wanting to write this story about a very specific period of time, 80 to 84.
Sure. What brought me to that point was writing a first memoir called Boy About Town, which came out over a decade ago. Which took me up to 1980. It was the story of a sort of childhood in London, falling in love with music and starting a music fanzine at the age of 13 and being sort of thrust quite quickly into the world of essentially post-punk. And so I left that one hanging a little bit. I don't want to be so bold as to say it was a cliffhanger, but it left me with the prospect of running a record label with a British rock star, pop star who'd expressed interest and whether I would stay at school or not. And people did ask about a sequel, and I really wanted to write a sequel. And this story needed to pick up where that one left off in the summer of 1980. And 1984, it got to a certain point where it felt like this story has been told for now, and this is where it needs to end. And a lot goes on in that time, both personally. It's a memoir. I'm 16, and it, by the end of the book, I'm 20. And music does change. UK punk, UK new wave, post-punk, whatever you want to call it, does turn pop. And I was fortunate enough to be very much on the inside, observing an enormous amount of it and living to tell the tale.
How does a young man such as yourself, so young, become someone who is on the front lines of this explosion?
Good question. I imagine some of it is dumb luck. But I also know from anybody who talks about this, an awful lot of it is graft. When I got into the to doing my fanzine at school, very, very quickly, I really liked doing it. And I thought this was something I wanted to do. But I was possessed. I would be jumping on buses into central London after I got out of school, and sometimes during school, and sometimes during the lunch hour to sell copies. I'd be going all around London to do interviews. I always was nervous doing it, but apparently people say I didn't come across nervous. I'd be calling people up cold to try and get interviews, walking into record shops to see if they'd sell copies of the fanzine. And I think a lot of people, I've been the same. I've worked with younger people. If you see somebody younger who's got both enthusiasm and a degree of, not quite sure it's the exact right word, is it nous or something? N-O-U-S, a degree of intelligence possibly about themselves, then you kind of want to help them. And so I doors open because I wasn't an idiot. I don't want to talk myself up. I maybe had something to contribute, but doors opened in a way when I was 14, 15, 16, that as this story kind of recounts, once you actually on the inside, and you're working on a sort of level playing field with other people on the inside, your youth doesn't really count for you so much anymore. It does sometimes, and at other times it does not. You've just got to be as good as everybody else.
Tell us about the relationship with Paul Weller.
Yeah, it's a complicated one. We haven't spoken in the longest of times. I was a Mad Jam fan. You know, that was my band, the coming out of coming out of the punk, maybe because I'd been a Who fan, and I still am a Who fan, and the Jam were like my generation's The Who, pun fully intended. And Paul Weller granted me an interview when the fanzine kind of got started getting serious, and we stayed in touch. And bit by bit, I sort of found myself welcomed into the Jam camp. It was a bolt out of the blue, a boy about town sort of ends with Paul Weller saying, "Hey, I've been thinking about starting a record label and thought you might want to run it." That's when I'm like barely 16. And that's pretty much where the book starts up a year later when I was 17. It took a whole year for it to come together, really just for him to figure out what he wanted to do. And at 17, we started running an indie label. We put out half a dozen singles until the Jam broke up at the end of 1982. And at that point, he did, you know, he was making a fresh start. And I didn't really see it coming any more than the other members of the Jam did. But after the Jam had broken up, et cetera, he was just like, you know, I don't want to do this label anymore. And that's the very, very simple story of it.
Because there's the dual narrative here is that you're doing this as part of a record label, but you also have your own band and you're looking for a record deal.
Very, very, very much so. So I had I honestly and truly, Joe, I only started writing or doing a fanzine because I wanted to be in music while my band was getting going.
Right.
I formed a band with a friend who was a drummer at the age of 11. At the age of 13 or 14, we finally got a bass player from our class. Somebody agreed to learn bass to join us. We were gigging at 15, and we opened for the Jam at 16. And when Weller set up the label, the band was called Apocalypse, by the way, and I've stayed very, very much best friends with one guy who joined the band when we turned into a five-piece, and we've been making music again together in recent years, which brings some of this full circle. But it was always, Paul Weller always said, you know, we should have your band on the label when you're ready. And when we were ready, he produced our debut single. It was a song written by my bandmate, so it wasn't my composition. And we were the last band ever to tour with the Jam. We played, you know, we did their for most of their final tour, and were literally the final support band on their last show in December 1982. But of course, when the record label went belly up, you know, we've got this band and we've suddenly got momentum in a way that maybe more so than the other bands that had been on the label we had going, because those other bands had sort of been through this a bit before. And when our label went bust, they were kind of like, oh, they lost the buzz, the spirit. And we were really ready to do something. And I think in many ways, what I'm telling the story of here in this book, because my own band sort of opens and closes the book in an intro and coda, and there are other parts in between. No band really sold out more than our own band. We signed with EMI and it was the kiss of death. The label spent a fortune, even by today's money, putting us in a residential studio for 2 weeks to sound like Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And we came out sounding like, you know, just terrible. And so harsh as I may occasionally seem on other people in this book, I think that when you're writing a memoir, the most, a really important thing is that, you know, the person that you should be hardest on is probably yourself. I mean, with some love, I think you want to have love for everybody. But it's important when doing a memoir, if you're going to be honest and you're going to be honest about your relationships with other people, I think you have to be honest about yourself. And if there, you know, there's a potential quality to this book and the predecessor that there's a lot of it's self-deprecation. It maybe some of it's just being willing to own up and open up to things I think sometimes we'd like to keep buried, to be quite honest.
The first book, Boy About Town, and now POW. And now POW, when UK punk went pop, 1980 to 1984. I was struck by, you say, Adam Ant was a pop star.
Yeah.
That this was now a statement of fact was also confirmation of a miracle. It gives you such an idea of the subtitle of the book, when UK punk went pop, of what was happening, of this miracle that was happening, not just to Adam Ant, but to many other musicians.
It did happen to many other musicians. And I think I'm glad you raised that, because I think Adam Ant was the first to make this about turn and to have sudden success. And he opened the doors for a lot of other artists to say, well, maybe if we just do this and do that, we too can have some of that success. Because Adam and the Ants had been a very underground punk band that had struggled to get a record deal. They didn't really write pop songs, and they dealt in a lot of erotic imagery, and record labels kind of wouldn't touch them. But their first album really caught on with hardcore punks who had their name, Adam and the Ants, on the back of a leather jacket, along with maybe Crass and the Sex Pistols or something. And then Adam and the Ants got broken up partly by Malcolm McLaren, because he started managing them and broke the band apart and turned three of them into Bow Wow Wow. And Adam went off and found himself new musicians and got himself actually his own record deal with CBS, what would now be Sony. And lo and behold, if he didn't come back and become a pop star. And it was a sort of sea change moment, because not only was Adam now getting number one singles, but a whole generation of leather jacketed punks had to find ways to basically black over the white Adam and the Ants on the back of the leather jackets that they painted on, because the guy had clearly sold out enormously and they wanted nothing to do with him.
So what does that say about success equaling selling out?
There is a great, again, really good one to ask. There is a quote way later in the book from Jeff Travis of Rough Trade Records, one of the most influential record labels ever, and also a central character in this story. The label may be more than Jeff, but Jeff was the figurehead for the label. Way towards the end of the book, I have been on top of everything else. I'm now a teenage TV presenter, and I for the Tube, and I'm interviewing Jeff Travis. It's a pre-recorded a sort of outside broadcast location interview at Rough Trade, and he's just signed the Smiths, and everybody's talking about the Smiths. And the big deal is that Rough Trade have actually signed the Smiths to a proper record deal, because Rough Trade used to just do that kind of 50-50 profit split and you can leave when you're unhappy, and bands kept being unhappy and leaving. So Jeff wanted to hold on to a band. But I asked him a very similar question, and he said something to akin to what it proves is that given the choice, the artist will always take the money.
Yeah.
That was what he said. And I think it holds true. It's hard, you know, when you're young. Like if I look at our own band and where we were 1920 and record companies dangle like a beautiful state-of-the-art studio at you, and you're watching other bands have number one hits, and whether it's like teenage kids like yourself, like Wham, who were very, very young, or maybe it's Frankie Goes to Hollywood and you're seeing the sensationalism and you've always dreamed of this. It's very, very hard to say, you know what would be better? Put us in a 16-track studio for 2 days and we'll make a record that will appeal to our audience and that will work. And then we can build from there. It takes a lot of bravery or a good manager to say, that's what we should do, rather than, wow, 2 weeks in a residential studio, you must love us.
Tony Fletcher is our guest. The new memoir, Powell, When UK Punk Went Pop, 1980 to 1984. For you in writing the book, is it more difficult writing about some of the personalities and the people and the stories than it was writing about you being a 16-year-old kid maturing and, oh God, girls, sex, all that stuff?
It's hard in both areas, because I mentioned earlier I had to sort of confront myself, and there's a great podcast out of England with a couple of really experienced music journalists who also did some TV work, and they pointed out not too long ago that the age of 18 is when you do most of your most stupid things, because you've got something like unimpeachable, it's invincible confidence and invincible ignorance.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And that is about right. So in terms of having to confront 18-year-old me, that was kind of hard work. With regard to other people, I think as we get older, I mean, most of us get hopefully softer in good ways. I don't mean necessarily politically or something, but we stop being so angry and we stop wanting maybe to provoke so much. And I don't, I haven't set out in this book to upset anybody else that I've written about. But I've also had to write honestly about relationships and, you know, it's not my goal. There are no scores to settle here whatsoever. I write about everybody with, from my perspective, internally, with love and appreciation for what everybody did to help. But it's still hard to actually then write something where maybe they weren't in the best light in their youth either.
So growing up in the 1980s, I mean, when a song comes on the radio now from that time and I hear it, I can pretty much tell you the first time I heard it, where I was, what I was doing, who I was with, dot, dot, dot. Do you still have that? Is there that visceral reaction when you hear something from Echo and the Bunnymen or Dexy's Midnight Runners that it impacts you?
Yes, absolutely. And if you wanted to even name a specific song, I could probably tell you when I first heard it. I think those moments are ingrained in all of us. I think researchers at major universities have sort of proven that it's the music that we really get into in our adolescence is the music that stays with us forever. And so there are certain moments when you remember when you first heard the song. And that can be really, really powerful. There are also kind of stories, you know, you mentioned Echo and the Bunnymen. It's not a spoiler alert. I write about their show at the Royal Albert Hall. They did a pair of them in 1983. No rock band, I should say, had played the Albert Hall in 10 years since Mott the Hoople. It was an incredible show. To this day, I think the best show I've ever seen. It would have been when, for example, I would have been introduced to The Killing Moon because it hadn't been recorded. It's in the set. The set was recorded. But I wouldn't have necessarily said that night, that's how I remember first hearing The Killing Moon. Most people would sort of gravitate to the radio or something.
Right.
I was very fortunate. I heard a lot of songs in the studio. I heard a lot of jam material being written and recorded in the studio. So my experiences of hearing some of the songs that meant a lot to me are gradual stages of hearing them come to completion.
Well, that's what made me think of the question, because you were there from really, and some of these, many of these songs for many of these artists from the ground up.
Yeah. And I am incredibly grateful for that experience. Again, now that this book is happening, I'm starting to be asked this kind of question. I scratch my head a little bit about my good fortune. But I go back to doors will open somewhat if you're young and have something about you. And I guess I also behaved reasonably well. There's also a couple of hilarious stories where, you know, I put bands up at my mum's house without telling her, because what would happen is I'd go to a gig or go to do an interview and the band would let on, or the artist would let on, you know, I'm down in London from Liverpool, that would be Pete Wiley with Wah, or from Aberdeen or Glasgow or Edinburgh, maybe it was one of those three, I'm sorry, which was the band Another Pretty Face, which became the Waterboys, Mike Scott,
right,
became the Waterboys. So two future pop stars and rock stars. And this was in the space of two or three weeks. And they let on that they'd come down to do this weekend Peel session in London and use the Peel session to pay for renting a van. And they got a gig on the back of it, but now they didn't have anywhere to stay. And I just said, oh, my mum's Scottish, she won't mind you staying. And I brought home this entire band, and she woke up to find them sleeping on the dining room floor. I should say, Mike Scott was a perfect guest. He was actually really good about having his band clean up after him, being polite, and they all got invited to stay a second night, and my mum loved it.
And that was sort of survival for bands, though. I mean, there was a lot of sleeping on floors, I assume.
There was a lot of sleeping on floors. I know I slept on enough of them. There really, really was. And people, you were just kind of used to roughing it when you were young. I want to resist. I always try and resist doing the you tell kids of today.
Yes,
you know,
right.
But I feel like we engaged in a lot more of that than did maybe the current generation. It was just not uncommon to go out and somebody would be like, you know, the last bus might be ready to go. And somebody would just say, well, you can crash at mine. I've got a sofa.
Right.
Yeah.
And not every 16, 17, 18-year-old was doing what you were doing of being this involved within music and the music industry.
No, not at all. My best friend at school, who I'm still really, really, really close friends with, he's in early sections in the book. His name's Richard. He there's a great story about us going to see the Jam in Manchester. And I neglected to tell him that the last bus from Manchester was leaving about 3 hours before the Jam went on the stage. And we ended up walking the streets of Manchester all night on Halloween night in 1980, which is not really very safe until the first bus. Richard has these war stories to tell his kids, but he always knew he was going off to college and going to become some kind of engineer. I mean, he always had that sense, and he did, and he did really, really well for himself. And other friends likewise. And even within my own band, it was very interesting. The three of us who'd been at school together, you know, I ended up down this path that we're talking about now. My bandmate, who was a better singer than me, and it was his song that Paul Weller produced, he went to art school, but bit by bit, as the band dreams faded, he got, you know, one job for life. And the drummer had always had this mentality, which you had to confront at times, and especially in a sort of Thatcherite Britain. It's like, where's the money? And so it's like, well, I'll play. Yeah. But as I turned 16, 17, I'm leaving school, I'm getting a job, and the band needs to earn money for this to work.
And it strikes me as I was reading that sort of the successes that were taking place in the UK prior, a generation or two before, of whether it be the Beatles or the Stones, I mean, that those footprints were still very much visible in the ground.
We were all very proud of, I believe we're all very proud of our British roots in terms of music, in terms of the 60s and the impact that the British bands had globally. The obviously when punk hit, there was a whole sense of it's time to kick over the statues, get rid of these bands.
Right.
It would be a cliche, but it's still worth saying to imagine that the Rolling Stones or the Who would still be going. At the age of 40, let alone at the age of 80, which is where those bands are right now.
Right.
But, you know, so the Who had credibility because there was something very rough about them. But within the punk generation, it was also, and particularly with post-punk, there was a sense of we're going to reconstruct music. It's almost like we're going to tear it down and then we're going to build it back up again in maybe, and maybe do it in a different order. You know, maybe like put windows on the floor and you know, ceilings on the side of the house, that kind of, if you see what I mean. And a lot of people really made some great music doing that, and yet it all sort of gravitated back to the mean, if you know what I'm saying. It all gradually came back to, well, what really works are 3.5 minute songs with hooks and record deals and albums and making a bit of money.
Right before I read your book, I was reading a book about Paul Simon's Graceland, which will be 40 years old, and 40th anniversary. And that came out in 86. So that story takes up in about 84, just when this one ends, from 84 to 86. And they're dealing with the record companies and radio and the fragmentation. And what you're talking about in your book is all what leads to that. And it's was fascinating to me because what radio was looking for, because in this point, it was say 84 to 86, they didn't know what they were looking for because it had been so fragmented. But you're ultimately part of the fragmentation of making it so that it was going in so many different directions. Shards of glass, if you will.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor, actually, the shards of glass. I think music should be fragmented, actually. I think the less categories we have, the better. And one thing I do like about younger indie music is that it doesn't really recognize barriers. You'll go see a live band now and they may all play guitars, but somebody else may be doing, you know, they're quite willing to bring in drum machines, synthesizers, glockenspiels. There's a lot less that I think bands are in general a lot less precious about being puritans or let alone puritanical. Part of the story, though, you mentioned about radio, you know, we're talking about UK punk went pop, but it's all set in England because I hadn't really left England by then much at all, you know, other than just like holidays. But the arrival of MTV does have an impact.
Right.
Because what we, you know, Adamant is the first example I'm using to be followed very quickly by the Human League. And also new acts are coming up. So like Depeche Mode, Soft Cell, they've got no past to worry about. The Human League had a past as a very independent avant-garde experimental act before they fragmented and Phil Oakey turned them into this synth pop group and an incredible synth pop group. But what happened, you know, that Adamant helped start to show and the others followed suit was, wow, not only can we get hit records in the UK, but there's America. And these videos that we've started making can save us doing an awful lot of touring, which might be handy because we don't know how Americans will take to synthesizers and not being like loud guitar bands. And so there is very much a sense that kicks in about halfway through the book that everybody's got one eye on the States. They may say otherwise, but they genuinely do, because clearly that's where the big money is. And MTV has a lot to do with that, even though we didn't get MTV in Britain. So I never saw it during the entire period of this book. MTV was like mythological to me.
But how aware were the groups? Like, were they saying, oh, we have Tainted Love, we're going to do a video, and you may not be aware of what that is here in the UK, but man, what it's doing in the US.
I think a couple of groups were, the moment you ask that question, I think of Duran Duran. And yeah. I have a sense that they really knew what they were doing and that they were making videos for American audiences and for this new MTV generation. I'm not sure that everybody else was. It would depend on the budget of the video, probably.
The new book, Powell. When UK punk went pop, 1980 to 1984, you're doing an event Sunday at the Orpheum?
Yes, I am. And I love doing events at the Orpheum. I've done some presentations on my previous books, like in the last couple of years, last few years, and they've all been very successful. And so we're actually going to launch the book there. It's out on the following Tuesday, but obviously we'll have copies on Sunday. I think it's at 2 p.m. And the nice thing about working with the cinema is that they have a screen, which means I can show some of these videos, which was a pleasant segue. It's not just reading from the book. I can talk about the era. I can show a couple of video clips. And a filmmaker and author himself, Stephen Blush, is coming in to host an In Conversation. Because one thing I really like about doing book events, if I attend one, I think we generally prefer somebody is actually hosting a conversation. And I'm doing that on all the events I have going in New York City and DC. And then I've got the whole of September, I'm doing a book tour in the UK with similarly a lot of really good authors hosting an In Conversation. So I think it's from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And we're, because they're a cinema, they've got to keep the movies turning around. We're also going to, if we need to, continue the conversation next door at the bookshop next door, Inquiry Mind. So that would be nice too.
All wonderful stuff. Again, the name of the book, Powell, When UK Punk Went Pop, 1980 to 1984, a memoir by Tony Fletcher. Tony, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the new book.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Tony Fletcher's new book is Powell, When UK Went Pop, 1980 to 1984. He will be at the Orpheum Theater in Saugerties this Sunday at 2 p.m. You can find out more at upstatefilms.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.